In this episode, I had a privilege to visit with Dr. Gert Grouse. He's a global director of education at Kidzania, world's fastest growing family entertainment brand and learning center for children. They are rapidly expanding around the world with 24 locations already operating in 19 countries and many new locations under the development right now, including but not limited to Frisco, Texas, along with their new headquarters. And I really, really enjoyed this conversation. We dive into a lot of topics, including, of course, education for our kids. So enjoy. Cheers.
This is the Tomas Show, your source for personal and professional development.
Welcome to another episode of the Tomas Show podcast. Today, I have a privilege actually to interview a gentleman that I got a chance to meet in person on one or two occasions, and he has impressed me from the moment that we've met. Dr. Gert Grouse, welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this.
No, absolutely. It was certainly a no-brainer. For those that might have not heard of Dr. Gert Grouse, he's a global director of education at Kidzania. And we will dive in here shortly what Kidzania is and what type of impact it creates for our children worldwide. And we've got a chance to meet during one of your visits in the city of Frisco, Texas, where you guys are pretty soon opening yet another location of Kidzania. So I want to talk about that as well. I want to talk about, a lot of your fascinating background and what you've been doing, for our kids, because your philanthropic experience is something that cannot go unnoticed and has to be emphasized and put on the pedestal. Your Dutch background, everything is important here that I want to highlight. And I want you, this is something that I would love for you to utilize as your, hopefully we can dive in depth here and get as much value for our listeners as possible, because you are a very, very fascinating individual, sir. So anyways, I want to start kind of, from your beginnings. It is my understanding that you're from Netherlands. Can you please talk about that a little bit and how has everything started for you back in Europe?
Yes, that's correct. I was born in the south of the Netherlands in a small town near Maastricht, where when I was born it was a pretty blossoming coal mining community. In a pretty conservative Catholic part of the Netherlands, and after a couple of years in my life, the coal mining community ceased to exist because the government decided that this was no longer as profitable as it might be. So the coal mines got closed down, and that. With hindsight, because I think if we sometimes, in the rush that is our life, if we sometimes just stop and take stock and reflect a little, mm-hmm. and learn our lessons, we might move forward better. And what effectively happened was that lots and lots of very proud people who'd earned a pretty decent wage were seen as skilled people doing a job not without risk. All of a sudden, those people lost not just their jobs, but with that lost their culture, I suppose, and their dignity. Mm-hmm. And of course, those coal mines were replaced with car factories and white goods industries, but things weren't the same. And the area, for quite a while, it took a good number of decades before the area found its own feet again. And I think the lesson that I certainly look back on now is that when such drastic actions are taken and you You reflect on the numbers that you might see on the news, so many people have lost their jobs, this, that, and the other. It is about much more than that. It is about communities. It is about how those communities are glued together, and when that glue gets undone, then the different pieces can fall apart. And that was to a significant degree certainly the case for the best part of a generation of people there. I went to school. I was a pretty good student. I was quite smart. I was also very bored, and my behaviour wasn't always as good as it might have been. Although I was also blessed to have one or two teachers who effectively set my world alight, and in particularly my German teacher who gave me a book, who didn't just teach me from a textbook, but who valued me enough to bring me a book and said, you're that good, you should read. So I became a German teacher because I had a brilliant German teacher who trusted me. And the lesson there is that the influence that we have as individuals, not just professionals, but as people, as role models for our children, is quite often underestimated. And my kind of my key role models from my youth really were my grandfather, the coal miner, Johan Cruyff, the footballer, who I just wanted to be like, but never quite achieved it. And my German teacher, who trusted me and believed in me, and who was responsible for me becoming a German teacher. So I went to university in the Netherlands, left the south of the Netherlands and went to university in the north, which in those days was quite a big thing because not too many people did that and not too many people left their immediate environment. And I got my degree in German and Dutch and pedagogy. I spent some time as a student in what was then East Germany and found that incredibly fascinating. And then became a teacher. And there I was. I was the teacher. And then I discovered that teachers in the Netherlands were relatively well paid. There were relatively few jobs, and some of the jobs that were available were in places where I didn't necessarily want to go. And then I saw in a newspaper, in a library, do you remember those? In a library, I saw an advert in a paper called the Times Educational Supplement. And the advert said, required urgently in Norwich, England, teacher of German 1 year only. And I kind of thought, well, if I go there, I'll have some experience under my belt, some quite unusual experience. So I phoned the principal of the school who said, why don't you come for interview? I went for interview and I was offered the job. And so all of a sudden, I was not just no longer in this small community in the south of Holland that I'd left to go to university anyway. I was now in a completely different country, getting ready to teach in an education system that I didn't know ever so much about, but there we are. So that's the kind of that's the first part in terms of growing up in the Netherlands and leaving it, I suppose.
But that's you know, as I listen, you know, it reminds me a little bit of my story, somewhat, and where I can relate with you because you left Netherlands at a pretty young age. I mean, you know, leaving, you know, just after college and going to another country. I mean, yes, Netherlands and UK might be different than Poland and US, but still, it's a very bold move. So, you know, what was your motivation behind it outside of the job? Was this you thought that this is going to be long term, you know, a better career opportunity, and perhaps just presented itself at the right time? Because you know, it's a gutsy move as well, to just kind of, you know, leave your home country, leave your family and friends around and, you know, and move to Norwich, United Kingdom.
I suppose it was. I think those days, I talk to my kids about this quite often, really. They were very different days, right? It's not that long ago, but there were very, very different days in terms of, just as an example, this was pre-COVID, deregulation of the airline industry in Europe. So the main, the airlines in Europe were the state airlines, Lufthansa, Air France, KLM, British Airways. Mm-hmm. And in those days, a flight from Amsterdam to London was not far of the equivalent of a month's salary. So people weren't traveling such a lot because it was so expensive. Part of the allure to come to the UK simply was I had an opportunity to do something that I never thought I could do. And I had a, I have this flashback as I'm speaking now. When I was a boy of about perhaps 12 or 13, we used to go on a geography field trip to Rotterdam, and mainly to Rotterdam Port, then the largest port in the world. And if you then went to Rotterdam railway station, you could see all the places that the trains would take the goods to, including Warsaw, including Moscow, including East Berlin. And I remember as a kid going home and then looking in an atlas and finding where all those places were and marking the places that I would quite like to go to. And somehow I wish I could find that atlas again and kind of compare how many places I did go to in the end and how many I didn't. So there was that allure of the new. It was adventurous. I would never have been able to afford it properly had I not gone for the job. I wanted to become a teacher desperately. That played a part of it. And kind of those things combined, plus the fact, remember, I was only going to go for a year. Mm-hmm. So I knew the bit that, well, if I don't like it, I'll just come back. But of course, what happens, and happens to so many of us in life, is 1 year becomes two because somebody says, actually, we quite like what you're doing. Why don't you stay a bit longer?
Absolutely.
And then you get promotion and you think, oh, I'm doing all right here. You've made new friends. And 1 year becomes five. And I was very blessed in the school I worked in. It was a new school. We started afresh. We knew the names of every child. It was a secondary school. We knew the names of every child. We knew the names of all the parents. It felt like a real educational community. And it had the most brilliant head teacher, Mrs. Daines, who is in her early 90s now, I believe. And she was very clear what she wanted the school to be like, but she was also very clear in how she empowered her staff to bring the best out of them for the benefit of the children. So once I'd done 5 years in the school, in one February day, she asked me to see her in her office, and she said to me something like, it is time you left. Which is quite an unusual thing to be told, and the human reaction is to become defensive and say, well, what have I done wrong? And her reply was, you've done nothing wrong. On the contrary, I just worry that if you stay here, you might go stale. Here is a job I think you should apply for in a far bigger school than this one, in another part of the United Kingdom. It's quite a senior job in that school. It was then the largest modern languages faculty in the country. And she said, and I've already spoken to the head teacher about you and given you a good reference. So along I went, and I got that job, and I moved to a place called Kingston upon Hull, on the northeast coast, and that was the next part of the adventure. So I was very fortunate in Norwich that I worked with some outstandingly kind and outstandingly brilliant teachers and people who just allowed me to become better at my job and better at being me.
So it almost like your principal at the time recognized that you have probably more talent that should be exploited in other areas on a higher level. Would that be correct?
Yes, and I think, and again, this is a hindsight thing, right? I think that's what good leaders do. I took that little bit with me. And I've tried to be at least a little bit as good as she was. With the people I've worked with, I think good leaders spot the potential in the people who they work with and facilitate for that potential to be realized.
No, I cannot cannot agree more with you.
That also means, Thomas, that you and she did that brilliantly too. You allow people to make mistakes and you allow people to learn from those mistakes rather than have an accountability framework that is so punitive that people are scared to make mistakes. She was also a brilliant people manager.
No, that's fantastic. And I'm sure, what I recognize in your voice is just a level of appreciation and gratitude for that lady, that she was able to do that and recognize that. What I'm curious is, Norwich is kind of east. It's, almost, at the North Sea coast, not too far from the sea coast, east of United Kingdom. And then when you move to Hull, that's, east of Leeds and Sheffield, also pretty close. How was that change, not only from a geographical perspective, but the living community, everything. I mean, how was that transition for you?
It was totally the opposite. So Norwich is a very beautiful city. It's reasonably affluent. It's quite provincial. It has a university that is cool and sophisticated. And Hull is or was an industrial port, a fishing port that had fallen upon bad times, where my new school was in a community that was severely deprived. And the other thing about the school in Norwich was it was a small school. It had in those days around 500 children. And I think it was a good school because it was a small school because everybody knew each other. And everybody looked out for each other. The school in Hull was a school with nearly 2,300 children and had more children in one year group than my school in Norwich had in the entire school. And I stayed there for 3 years. I loved the kids, but I recognized very quickly that big schools are not good news. In the school, we knew the children who were problematic, and we knew the children who were at the top end, and that big group in the middle, I'm afraid, got lost somewhere. And I didn't even know the names of all the teachers.
I see. So you felt better, obviously, in a smaller model where
many years later, in a meeting with the then Minister for Education for England, I was asked my view on the optimum school size, which actually was an economic question I was being asked. But I gave an educational answer, and my educational answer was, the optimum school size is where every member of staff knows something good about every child. And the reply I got, that's not what I meant. And I said, I understand, Minister, that that's not what you meant, but it is the right answer. And you may not like it, but it is still the right answer. And I stayed in the school in Hull for 3 years. And one of the reasons I did leave after 3 years is because I had some great colleagues there. People worked incredibly hard, but the model and the system that is basically based around economies of scale is wrong. It is principally wrong to treat our children as a commodity and as a number and as an amount of money. So I left. After 3 years, I moved from Hull. I was a language teacher, as you know, and I became advisor for modern languages in Manchester, where there were, in those days, around maybe 40 secondary schools and probably around 150 primary schools. And I introduced modern languages, French, German, Spanish, and Italian, into all primary schools in Manchester, and had a great time there. And this was a good time. It was in the early 1990s when we were heading towards a more enlightened government as well, that took a different view of education and children rather than the staunch conservative government under Mrs. Thatcher, which treated the public sector as an economic commodity, which of course it can never quite be. So that was my move from Hull to Manchester, which I was glad to make.
I almost I'm thinking, trying to position it from a timeline perspective. I mean, that was kind of early to mid 90s. I mean, that's primary Manchester United right there. I mean, I remember growing up watching these guys. Are you a big soccer or, you know, European football fan?
So when I moved to Manchester, it was quite an interesting one. When I moved to Manchester, Sir Alex Ferguson was in his...
Yes.
He hadn't been at Manchester United for that long, but my arrival, sadly, I have to say, entirely unconnected. My arrival in Manchester coincided with the arrival of Eric Cantona at Manchester United. and of course, as they say, the rest is history.
It's history,
I love Manchester as a city. It is a tough city. It is an industrial city, of course, the heart of the Industrial Revolution. It has known significant decline, but it has a people who are immensely honest and immensely resourceful and resilient. It's reflected in its sports. It's reflected in its reactions to terror attacks, be that the 1996 terror attack by the IRA, or the one fairly recently during the Ariana Grande concert. It has a people that stands up and sing "Don't Look Back in Anger," and I loved Manchester for it. And even as a Manchester United supporter, and of course we're not doing so well at the moment.
Yes,
I am still happy that Manchester City is doing well, because I'd rather a Manchester team win than a Liverpool one or a London one. So,
I grew up playing soccer, so watching, you know, Peter Schmeichel and Eric Cantona, obviously for those, he's French, Ryan Giggs, Roy Keane, I mean, Paul Scholes, David Beckham, for that matter. I mean, that team was something else. And I remember just being glued to the TV in Poland, watching these guys play. So
Very special. I mean, football, I think football in my life has been incredibly important. There was something very special about that team, because they were from their own academy, right? They were their own players. Mm-hmm. They'd come through the Manchester United system. And I'm absolutely convinced that all of that was to do with Alex Ferguson and his approach to life. Just like the successes of Manchester City now are predominantly due to Pep Guardiola and how Pep Guardiola was influenced by Johan Cruyff, who was my hero, who I used to go and watch as a boy, mm-hmm. and greatly admired as a manager later. And I quote from his book, or his autobiography, certainly a great deal, because I think he was a great leader. So I think in both the Manchester clubs, they have been very fortunate to find people in charge who almost do that Barcelona thing that says "Mesca un club," more than a club. And Manchester United, and especially Manchester City, are not just clubs, they are communities. They function in those communities. And in England, sport, like in many parts of the world, sport, and particularly soccer, is incredibly important to people. It's an escape. in many ways. And most cities, of course, have two clubs. I live in Sheffield now. Mm-hmm. We have Sheffield United and Sheffield Wednesday. We have Manchester United, Manchester City, Everton, Liverpool. And those rivalries are more often than not good rivalries. So it's part of our community.
Well, I think it's, I remember growing up and playing basketball in different places. I mean, that interpretation of, being as a community is spot on. I think communities treat it as religion almost. I mean, it's something that they just look forward to more than anything else in a particular week. It was something I never could really experience. I have yet to see like a real, Premier League game, but I definitely will go and see one. Maybe we can go together one day.
Yeah. I think, incidentally, that there is a slight word of caution around what's going on at the moment. So you quite rightly referred to the Manchester United of the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the players in those days came from the greater Manchester area.
Mm-hmm.
Knew what winning against Liverpool or winning against Manchester City meant to its many, many fans. I think now the Premier League in particular is such a commercial beast that part of that community feeling is getting lost. It's expensive to go, and it's expensive to watch on TV. And almost all of the players who now play for Manchester United or play for Manchester City or for Liverpool actually don't belong to those cities and their communities. And to them, it is probably just a job. Yet to the fans, it is more than just a sport. And I think there is a disconnect developing, which I think is regrettable. And hopefully we can get that back.
No, and I see that. I think it, not only soccer or European football, but basketball specifically, a lot of sports here in US are becoming or have already become huge financial machineries almost, to the extent of, it's more about how much money the sport can produce. As opposed to for these communities to really embrace what's going on and have something pleasant to watch and inspire, the children to do something outside of, technology scaling to the, unprecedented levels. So that's what I was doing. I was watching these games and that inspired me to play. So I hope, to your point, It's not going to be only the financial, machinery, but it will the community feeling will never be lost or perhaps be more embraced as it always has been, especially in the 90s, just like we were talking about.
I agree entirely. Yes.
So you were going back to kind of your journey. So Manchester, Salford, I think is on the suburbs too, right? That's kind of where you spend a part of your career.
So I did a number of years in Manchester as languages advisor, and then my boss moved to Salford, which is the city next door to Manchester, and moved there as director of education, and rang me up not long afterwards and said, would I moved to Salford with him as senior inspector,
mm-hmm.
Which I was immensely flattered. I said yes. I moved to Salford, which is a smaller authority than Manchester. It is more deprived and in many ways more challenging. But I loved the schools. I loved the principals I worked with. And I moved there at a time, mid to late 90s, when we had a new Labour government in the UK under Prime Minister Tony Blair, which filled the country with a degree of optimism, political optimism, that I've not experienced since, and I fear I'm unlikely to experience again in my lifetime. The theme tune of the Labour Party campaign in 1996-97 was "Things can only get better." They were right, and they got better because the focus was very clear and very simple. To repeat the Tony Blair mantra, education, 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 and they invested in education and created new accountability frameworks which were much more focused on the child rather than on the system. So the years between 1997 and 2007, which was the end of Tony Blair's prime ministership, were educationally, or there were good years to be in education in the UK. And I stayed in Salford for about 3 years, had great success and great joy in the job, and was then approached by the government whether I wanted to lead locally on a new initiative called Education Action Zones, which is a fund, an education funding partnership between the private sector and the state sector, and was focused very heavily on deprived areas. And the area I went to was called Wythenshawe, which is in South Manchester, mm-hmm. adjacent to Manchester Airport. And Manchester Airport was the private sector sponsor in this initiative. And so my chairman was the group chief executive of Manchester Airport, the wonderful Jeff Muirhead. And but what it also did, it allowed us to take the education agenda out of local politics. Because what the Blair government had recognized quite correctly, that in certain parts of the country, there was a level of local political interference that was so unhelpful that it stopped the progress the children merited. And I enjoyed that. I had an absolute whale of a time. I did that for a good number of years. And then, as always happens with these initiatives, and I think it's a big flaw in the Western world around education and accountability frameworks, and that is that when a politician is elected and makes certain promises, when they seek re-election 4 or 5 years later, those promises have to be met. And if they're not met, then they haven't got the patience to continue and take a slightly longer term view. So in many countries in education, the view, the vision, is never any further, the horizon is never any further away than 4 or 5 years. And that has to be fundamentally wrong, because I'd be so bold as to say that in many countries, Western countries, it's taken us since the Second World War to get it wrong. So it's taking us 70 years to get it wrong. How on earth can you expect us to turn that round in 4 or 5? So it is a shame that longer-term vision and consensus around big issues. Why in the United States can't the Democrats and the Republicans, or in the UK, Conservatives and Labour, why can they not at least in principle agree what the route forward is for education, for health? And of course, every government will have its slight variance on this. But ultimately, we have to stop messing around with systems and focus much more on the children and what our society needs from those children when they're grown up.
What do you think, to that point, what do you think the source of those disagreements is? You know, in particular countries, not only in UK and US, but I cannot agree with you more. I see this, I observe it, and I think that there's, you know, politicians tend to... perhaps, in my genuine belief, get caught up with what they're doing too much, as opposed to focus on executing some of their visions, to an extent, of course. So do you think that's the source of that, or perhaps there is a different meaning?
I think that's absolutely part of it. I also think that politicians have to recognize that they're not experts, and they also have to recognize that that they need to make decisions that are evidence-based. So in the United Kingdom, our previous Prime Minister, Mrs. Theresa May, for example, wanted the reintroduction of grammar schools, quite frankly, for no other reason than she went to one. Because there is absolutely no educational or scientific evidence, research, that says that those schools are part of an education system that is better for the children or indeed for society. So I think politicians need to set out a vision, but I think they really need to listen to people and to experts as to how that vision might get turned into a reality, how much that might cost, what the pitfalls might be, and indeed how long it might take, or indeed whether the whole thing is right in the first place. And I think our politicians increasingly, particularly if I look at your president, for example, are far too active being populist than doing the right thing. So I think it's an almighty mess at the moment, but very, very little of what's going on at the moment is evidence-based. Why do the two parties not agree? I think in part that is historical. I think where you have a two-party system, it would always be very hard for the two parties to agree on major things, because otherwise the electorate would be confused and wouldn't understand at all who to vote for. If you look at a country like Germany, which since 1945 has had coalition governments, I would argue that the political decision-making in Germany is better because its politicians have to make decisions by consensus. Making decisions by consensus means that you have to be able to listen to other people's views. And these things take time. But I think that is absolutely right. And if I look at the education system in Germany, not perfect, because perfect doesn't exist, but if I look at the education system in Germany, I am absolutely convinced that the changes they have made are far less erratic than elsewhere, but the system, the changes they have made are evidence-based, and the system as a whole is infinitely better than in most other countries.
Absolutely. You know, since we're already on that topic, I'm curious to hear your viewpoint on one thing. And in particular, I see, you know, I'm 32 years old. I've been fortunate to come here, earn 2 degrees in an American, system of education. However, the generation behind me, or just, you know, younger people for that matter, in their 20s, teens, there's a lot of debates around education period and having, resources around us that allow us to really obtain particular skill sets to do the job that, you know, we desire to do, as opposed to actually, you know, go to college or, you know, and spend 4 or 5 years in an academic institution. And in US in particular, a lot of families are in debt. It's a little different structure from an educational perspective than in Poland, for that matter, where a lot of education is obviously funded by the government, so those institutions are public. So it's a little different approach how those degrees are earned and then obviously utilized and seized. But what would you tell, you know, a young person, talking to their parents, and they, you know, put emphasis on education, on going, you know, to get your studies, get your degree, taken care of just for general curriculum purposes, and that child, you know, that young individual says, you know what, mom and dad, I think I can just take some courses online and probably be more well off than go to college. What would you say to that young person as an expert in the field of education?
I think it's a very, very difficult one, because it's, and we see we see similar issues here. But these things are entangled with a whole range of complexities. So let me use the UK or England in particular as an example, mm-hmm. where a number of years ago, tuition fees were introduced, effectively student loans. Yeah, that hadn't existed beforehand. And all of a sudden, in order to go to university, students needed to take out a loan of approximately, I don't know, at current rates, $10,000-$11,000 per year over a 3-year period. And then they can pay that loan back over a period of time and at low interest rates. So the intention was to create a level of equality and be able to afford the degree from a government perspective to run the degree courses.
Mm-hmm.
So that was. Can I just, Thomas? I apologize profusely.
No problem.
No worries. My wife's just walked in, which sets the dog off in its nicest possible way. So effectively, what happens is something's done for a reason, which people think is the right reason. However, it is very difficult. If I'm a family where the parents are not wealthy or are poor, and my daughter wants to go to university and take out a loan, $11,000 a year is an enormous amount of money. I've never seen that amount of money in my life before. So I think the decisions that those young people, before they go to college or university here, mm-hmm. are then faced with are not educational decisions. They are partly historical decisions. They're partly decisions that come from their family and that family's socioeconomic context and background. So you're heaping a whole lot onto the scales of these young people who are then expected to make a decision on educational grounds. And what we're seeing now in England is that the number of people applying to go to university are fewer and fewer, particularly from the lower socioeconomic backgrounds, and that those students are pursuing alternative routes such as modern apprenticeships, whereby the debt levels are far less, and actually they're almost they learn on the job and they are educated on the job. So I think it also shows, incidentally, how far our civil servants and politicians who introduced this policy with the best of intentions, how far they are actually removed from the reality of the people they purport to represent. I think my advice to parents, and it's difficult for me to put this into a USA context, mm-hmm. my advice to parents and students would always be to seek as many opinions from as many different fields, if you wish, areas, people, mm-hmm. as you can.
Yeah, I remember, just to give you some context, it might give you a better idea of what I went through. Perhaps you can, elaborate more as you find out a little bit more facts. So growing up in Poland, obviously, like I was telling you, public education system, it's the country is, I think, still very corrupted. It's unfortunate, but that's what happens, on the higher levels of government. I think, I'm not sure about education per se, but so there was a choice, to go to a public institution and apply. And obviously, there's a merit how you get in and why you should get in. And then I think, I'm not really sure what's going on now, but I think they started collecting some tuition for different courses and perhaps some extracurriculars and whatnot. So it's changing a little bit, but it's still heavily funded by the government. So if I were to stay in Poland, that was my option one. And then, in my teenager years, I had an opportunity to come here, which was, looking back, it's something that is incredibly fortunate. Sports obviously have blessed me with all these opportunities. But, you know, I went to an institution here locally, Southern Methodist University. Love the school and the life that it has blessed me with following graduation. But the school, I mean, it's, I think the tuition is $50,000-$60,000 a year in tuition. That excludes, I think, board and all the other expenses. You know, I'm not sure how the insurance is rolled in and everything else. But if I compared those two opportunities, I mean, it's completely, I mean, it's honestly hard to comprehend. It's hard to comprehend what I was presented with. And at the time I was like, you know, I would be silly if I didn't take advantage of that opportunity and indeed pursue those education. And as I saw my friends, you know, some of them were paying tuition. Some of them still have student loans that they have to pay. Some of them had heavy scholarships, heavy level of that were subsidized as well. A lot of financial aid involved. So it almost makes me sad, you know, because education is becoming so, so expensive, specifically in U.S. Now, my school is private, so obviously in some public institutions across the country, you have some local funding that is available. And I think that decreases the cost substantially. However, it's a completely, completely different system. And as I look at some of my friends that I grew up with, I mean, the opportunities that they had, tremendously different. And it's just, you know, it makes me wonder. It makes me wonder because education is a huge, huge component of our lives. Obviously, you know, I just got married with, you know, and my wife and I are aspiring parents. So we think about, you know, okay, what's the best for our kids, future kids? Is it to be here? Is it to, you know, raise them somewhere else? You know, depending on circumstances, I think we're both very global oriented. So that's something that is definitely on our minds.
I mean, I think it's also an interesting one, isn't it? That supposedly the more sophisticated we become as societies, you could easily argue that we're now less equal than we've ever been. Yeah, in terms of educational access, what you'd mention, $50,000-$60,000, well, what percentage of a population, never mind how bright the kids are, what percentage of a population can even dream of affording that? That's the same.
It's insane. It's honestly, you know, to give you some insight, perhaps. I mean, the kids that go to, I mean, the school is in the heart of Dallas. And again, you know, the sole reason why I was able to get there is because of the athletic scholarship. Yeah. Otherwise, I wouldn't even dream of coming here or approaching my parents to even paying a portion of it. I mean, it's really ridiculous. So talking about what opportunities are in front of us, not everybody get those opportunities. Obviously, there's levels of education in different countries being available. And then, you know, what makes me wonder is how those degrees then in particular countries position you to advance in the workforce, because that's a huge conversation. I mean, I look at my brother and what he's doing now, and he has 2 degrees and he's in Poland. I look at some other friends, you know, some of them want to go to Europe. Some of them want to come here, potentially go to Canada or Norway for that matter. It's very, very popular when I talk to folks lately. So it's interesting. It's interesting how your education or their lack of, if you go to college, impacts your life, perhaps to follow, depending on circumstances. Because I know people also, I mean, I just interviewed, you know, a gentleman on the podcast. I mean, he's in early 20s, way beyond his age in terms of maturity. You know, went to a college in Berkeley in California and dropped after a year and a half to start his own business. So it's I think that the a lot of things are changing these days, and it's just fascinating for me to see, you know, how different people go through their journeys throughout the system.
But I also think what we see increasingly, And when I visit places like Moscow, you can, and I could indeed do in Warsaw, you can have those conversations about years gone by. So if I've got to pay a lot of money for my degree course, then one of the things that I want to make sure of when I finish my degree course, that I can pay that money back and that I get my money back, that I earn well for the rest of my life. So therefore, the degree courses that become very popular are the ones that lead to professions that pay well. Yeah, and therefore, you have to ask from a society's point of view, you have to ask the question where the next Dostoevsky is coming from, or where the next Rachmaninoff is coming from, or Salvador Dali, because in the end, we are education system rather than our education for career system will begin to leave out significant elements of our lives because of financial or lack of financial prospects.
Oh yeah. And it makes me, you know, it's very sad because one of the biggest values, I think, that college not only possesses, obviously, from a learning perspective, but the social aspect of things, right? Like if you don't really engage in any conversations, if you don't build those social circles and build friendships that last for a longer period of time, I think that carries over to workforce later on. And I think those young people then struggle to build interpersonal skills and communication skills because their skill set could be purely technical. And as a result of which, you know, that limits them then to grow in other areas, perhaps where, you know, I think that skill set is, it could be beneficial wherever they go. And technical skills obviously are very desired these days. But, you know, I could, if I was a programmer or web designer and I couldn't communicate how that benefits an employer, that doesn't help me in any capacity, right?
I think there's an interesting, I honestly think that I mean, these things are complex, right? But I think that what we're beginning to see in quite a tangible way is a clash between the demands of the children and young people themselves and how they live their lives through technology, etc. The world becoming a much smaller place in real travel terms and through the internet. The demands of the world of work changing incredibly rapidly. You just think the last 10, you know, the iPhone 3G is only 10 years old. Mm-hmm. Think what's happened in those 10 years and how kids have had to react to that. Yet we have an education system where we still put 30 people in a classroom. Yeah, and there is, that tension is becoming more and more pronounced. And there's an interesting exercise that I sometimes do, and I'll try it with you now and just picture it and for your listeners to picture it. Picture an airport of 100 years ago and picture an airport now.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Picture a hospital operating theater of 100 years ago and picture one now. Picture a shopping mall of 100 years ago and picture one now. Picture a factory, a car factory of 100 years ago and picture one now. And then picture a classroom of 100 years ago and picture one now. And I think if you have the same pictures or remotely the same pictures as I have, then in all except the classroom one, the differences are enormous.
Absolutely.
But the classroom one has still got 30 desks in, and it might be a whiteboard instead of a blackboard. But apart from that, there isn't that much change. I think it is a really good way of expressing how we are falling behind very rapidly and we are not keeping up with the change as is required.
So on that note, you know, I know your time is valuable, but I want to dive into something obviously that is, currently, your occupation, you know, it's something that you've been doing, for, let's see, I'm a diligent student of your LinkedIn profile for over five years, it appears, or roughly 5 years. And I feel like our whole conversation kind of spins all around what type of value proposition Kinzania is providing. So I see now, based on kind of your viewpoints, you know, who you are as a person, as an educational expert, supporter, you know, really vocal, obviously. So I see where how they, you know, I'm curious, how did they find you to begin with? Because that's, you know, I'm very, very excited let's say first what Kidzania is, you know, educational entertainment center where children can truly experience, you know, the world of work through different types of role plays, which is fascinating to me. And you guys are coming to Frisco, Texas here. And I'm pumped because if we decide to, you know, stay here long term, you know, for the next decade or more, it appears we're going to be here for the next couple of years at least. But you never know what happens with life. You know, that education entertainment center, I anticipate for it to be something that is, I mean, it's revolutionary. It's something that I don't think many people grasp what this is, what's coming. I mean, they might have heard or read in articles or whatever the case is, but I'm just very excited. So talk about Kidzania a little bit, you know, and how did the organization find you?
So Kidzania itself is 20 years old this year, and it started in Mexico City. It is the brainchild of its founder and still president, Javier López Ancona, who I'm very proud to say has become a personal friend over the years. It was his genius 20 years ago that kind of started to look at why can we not build a city for children where through the medium of role play, children learn to express themselves and become familiar with money, earning money, spending money, saving money, with working and all the values that and work ethics that sits around that. And so it was open in Mexico. There was a second one open in Mexico. And then it kind of worked its way around the world from Tokyo to Bangkok to London and Moscow and Lisbon to soon in South Africa to Dubai and Qatar and many other places, including Sao Paulo and Chile. I'm trying to think where else I've been. But soon, very soon, the clock is ticking. We will open the first Kidzania in the United States in Frisco, Dallas. And I'm extraordinarily excited. We're blessed to have a brilliant team of people in the States under the brilliant Greg Stevens, who is the CEO of Kidzania USA. And I stumbled into Kidzania. And part of the thing I think about, you know, that conversation that we were having about becoming me is kids also need to realize that there are no straight lines. Stuff happens in life, and good stuff happens in life, and then you make decisions, and those decisions mean that you go down a certain road and not down another one. So when I'd finished working with Manchester Airport in the Education Action Zone, I started, I was the founding chief executive of an NGO called Children's University, and it was all about children's out-of-school hours learning and the value that can bring. Going to a museum, a gallery, a zoo, whatever. Because what increasingly is happening across the world is that our in-school curriculum is incredibly narrow because we test everything. So therefore, it becomes very prescriptive so that you can test how well the schools teach the children what the governments think the children should be taught. And schools get inspected and inspection reports get published. So we must draw a very clear distinction between schooling and education. They are not the same. You know, schooling clearly is part of education, but only the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, 9 to 4 part. Yeah? Whereas education starts from the second you're born until the second you move on. And I started this Children's University thing, and it became a kind of a bit of a global phenomenon, really. And in doing that, I met lots of people, and I made lots of friends, and including my friend Joel Cadbury in London, who then at some point rang me up and said, "Have you heard of Kidzania?" And I kind of went, "Yeah, a little bit, and I really like the concept." And he said, "Well, we're thinking of getting involved in the franchise. Will you come and advise us?" And as a friend, that's what I did. I used to travel down to London occasionally and spend a couple of hours there. And then at some point, that couple of hours became a couple of days, became weeks. And in the end, the guys in London said, "Look, why don't you just come and join us as education director?" Which I did. That became quite a successful thing quite quickly. And then I got a phone call from Mexico City, from Javier López Ancona, saying, "Would you like to come to Mexico for dinner?" Which seems like a very long way to go for dinner, but I did anyway. And I was basically asked whether I wanted to do this piece globally. And essentially, you know, what's happening with Kidzania is it's age 4 to 14. We aim to be for all children. So every Kidzania in the world works very hard to be able to welcome even those kids who come from more deprived backgrounds. We just find ways of doing it. I was very proud, for example, that in Mumbai we were able to bring 75,000 children from the slums in Mumbai to Kidzania, Mumbai. Next year, that number will go up. So we work really hard on that. And then it's about children's experiences. So they come to Kidzania. One of the things, as you know, Thomas, one of the things in Kidzania is that grown-ups are there to be seen and not heard. So therefore, once the children are inside, it is their city and the grown-ups can't interfere. And it is 4 hours of children having a great deal of fun, doing jobs from radio presenting to operating theatre in the hospital to mending cars to being an astronaut to flying planes to writing the front page of a newspaper, you name it. Each Kidzania has about 60 professions like it. And what effectively happens is a number of things. One is, and I'll talk a little bit about research in a while, but what it begins to do for kids who go to schools to have to deliver this very narrow curriculum is, sorry, I must introduce you to Oblio. That was Oblio, who is the cat, who knows that next door there is food. That goes next door, United States of America. That was Oblio. And effectively what happens is the children begin to realize, in a sense, why they go to school. Very simple example. I'm in London. I'm talking to three girls outside the Metro newspaper activity. And I ask them about how they like English at school and how they... and what they like and what they don't like. And the answer is, it's okay, but we don't like writing very much because we don't see what the point is. Until we came here and did the front page of the newspaper, and now we understand why we have to do English at school, because it has a very practical application. So that's one simple example. There are thousands of those examples all over the world. But that's one very simple example of where Kidzania becomes the, you know, the theory into practice, the appliance of science, the awe and wonder with the theory. That's one thing. And then the other thing is we've done a significant piece of research, which we're doing globally. And of course, Dallas Frisco will become part of this, which we call the Global Barometer of Children's Aspirations, i.e. we look at very large numbers of children and we look at what their first choice is when they come to Kidzania. And then when we have those numbers, over 500,000 kids, then we ask ourselves, who are these children? Are they 4? Are they 14? Are they boys? Are they girls? Are they black? Are they white? Are they rich? Are they poor? Are they urban? Are they rural? Which country are they from? And the findings are so important that organizations like OECD, the United Nations, the Council of Europe, the government in Dubai, and in Qatar, and in other places, including the UK, are taking note of these findings. So here go the headlines. All stereotypes are set at the age of 4. So if you go into the aeroplane, boys become pilots, girls become cabin crew. There is almost no change between 4 and 14. almost all girls choose activities below their age range. So there's clearly a self-confidence issue. Almost all boys choose activities at least commensurate, if not above, their age range. And then finally, children can only aspire to what they know exists. So kids from very poor backgrounds with limited life, with a limited menu of life experiences, will never choose the aeroplane or the operating theater as their first activity, but they will choose working in the supermarket or making beds in the hotel as their first activity. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. And in the end, I don't mind which professions children choose. What I mind is that they need to be aware of all the choices that exist for them. And that is where the unfairness lies. So Kidzania has gone from being an entertainment provider to an edutainment organization, although I hate that term, but I can't think of a better one, that contributes very significantly to the global education debate. And over the last couple of years, I'm now on the global advisory board of Junior Achievement Worldwide. I'm on the global advisory board of BET, which is a huge conference organizing organization. I advise the government in Dubai on changes in the education curriculum. And all of this has come out of the work of what is effectively not a school, not an education system, but something where children learn outside of the school environment. And I'm not just saying this, this is really important. Of course I'm saying this about Kidzania, but I would say the same about museums, I'd say the same about galleries, I'd say the same about farms. There are experiences that children have to be exposed to in order for the whole thing to make sense, for them to join up the dots and to understand purpose. And we have to understand that purpose leads to passion. And when passion is there in abundance, you know what? You don't need to push them to learn. They'll come and knock on the door to do so. So we need to turn it inside out and upside down.
No, I cannot agree more. That's such a powerful statement that you just made. You know, finding your passion and, you know, and that would come knocking on the door if you certainly test different things. And I think, you know, Kidzania is providing that and significantly more. You guys have such a, you know, global presence. It is my understanding 27 cities, 21 countries, 5 continents, and further developments in additional 20 locations. I mean, that's an amazing, amazing impact. And it appears you guys engaged with over 72 million plus children since 1999. I mean,
and I think with that, what's really important, right? And we have. I think when you do these things, you also have certain duties and responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And the world that we occupy at the moment, as I think we've kind of touched on, is not a particularly good place, is it? And our leaders are, by and large, or very often, are not people that we would aspire to be like because of their values and virtues. So our generation has kind of made a bit of a mess of all of this. And I also think if we can create, and that has to be our next step, I feel, if we can create a community of Kidzanians where the kids from Sao Paulo interact with the kids from Dallas and the kids from Dallas interact with the kids from Lisbon, etc., and they learn to understand each other better through normal interactions, then maybe, just maybe, our next generation will be slightly more considerate and will consist of better leaders than the ones we've got at the moment. We have to live in hope.
No, I completely agree. I think one of the best things that can happen to a young individual or our kids is exposure, and I've been blessed with that myself. Exposures to folks from different countries, different areas of the world, different ethnicities, different colors of skins, different beliefs, because I think that just broadens your lens, your landscape, your perspective is much larger. And I think if you, you know, you may be just in one place, you know, since, and a lot of people, unfortunately, they don't have these opportunities, and they are in one place their whole life. And as a result of which they're kind of, I don't want to say limited, but they just haven't been blessed with more than some of us. So I certainly hope that your vision, you know, will come to fruition, where you, your respective locations can collaborate more, and kids can, you know, make friends with others in particular, different particular countries. You know, as I listened to your story here, I mean, I'm not surprised that you are where you are. You have an immense level of expertise, obviously, around the field of education. But I think, you know, you're so passionate about it. I can just hear it in your voice. And I think Kidzania, with their really modern level of implementation to support our children, really suits your skill level, your qualifications, and obviously your exponential background. You know, working, you know, as a teacher, as a you know, local, you know, local governments and beyond, local universities and beyond that. So that's I'm not surprised one bit. I think Kidzania is definitely as I listen to you, fortunate to have you here. I'm curious, you know, before we wrap up, I'm curious to hear, you know, what's a challenge that you can think of that Kidzania has. One challenge going forward, and what are your expectations, you know, for the Frisco location?
I think the challenge forward is to stay real and relevant in a world that's changing incredibly fast. Yeah, and not to go just down the tech route, but how can we stay relevant for the 8 year or for an 8 year old in 2030? Yeah? And so the part of the answer to the challenge is to engage better and more with our young people. I think that's the real challenge, and staying relevant and staying relevant to the futures of children, not just their careers, but to principles and to values. I think the Frisco Kidzania is incredibly important, because I think it's a bit like United States of America in Kidzania terms at the moment is like fresh snow. Mm-hmm, no, mm-hmm. Nobody's walked on it. And the first footprint will be in Frisco. And the quality of the next footprint and the size of the next footprint, which will be Chicago and New York and many other places, will significantly depend on how well we all do, industry partners and Greg's team and the global team and us and the local community. If we do as well, nearly as well as we think we can do, we will essentially shine a light for the rest of the states, and many people will come and look at that first footprint in the snow, and admire it. I think I'm very optimistic. I think it'll be. I can't wait. You know, there is an opening date muted. I will see you there. We will spend an evening together talking about Manchester United, which I'm delighted that you're a fan, and we will make with the Frisco community. We will make that Kidzania very special, and so special that the rest of the states are going to take note and learn and take things away from it.
No, I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward to it, to its opening. I'm carefully also studying, you know, what's going on in the community and you know, with things like PGA of America coming here, and you know, another public-private partnership that will allow our kids to have even more opportunities, you know, to develop, you know, their golf game, and you know, Frisco being a hub really for sports and for kids to really become athletes. I think it's been fun to see. And now with you guys coming in, it's going to add even more value for our kids to utilize. So I'm just grateful that, you know, I'm part of this community, and I look forward to really see, you know, what happens, you know, near Stonebriar Mall and how you guys, you know, take things really to the next level here for our children.
I was very excited that time we met. I was very excited by the community in Frisco, by the business community, where I know that my colleagues are working with schools and districts, that they're working with universities about evaluative elements of and curriculum elements of Kidzania. They have a number of US-wide education advisors who they've managed to bring on board. So I'm extraordinarily excited, but the spirit that existed in that meeting, in that Chamber of Commerce meeting, if memory serves me right,
yes,
in that hall in Frisco, was electric. It had a really good feel about it. And if we can keep that going, then hey, you know, everybody's a winner, but first and foremost the kids are a winner, and that has to be the right thing.
No, I think my genuine feeling is that you guys will accomplish a great level of success. I think this community is very electric. You know, with I want to say roughly 180,000 residents just in Frisco alone, but I think you will see a lot of folks coming from McKinney, from Plano, from Collin County, from Dallas for that matter. I look at this region, not just Frisco, but truly Dallas Fort Worth, and it's something that is very exciting. So I honestly have no doubt in my mind that this will be a huge, huge success for you guys, that then you guys will be able to I don't want to say clone, but you know, take those lessons and apply them in other locations like you said, Chicago, New York, and other geographical areas where you have plans to open up. So I'm very pumped for you, very excited, and I can't thank you enough. You know, I want to again be respectful to your time. I loved our conversation. I thought it provided a lot of insight, and hopefully. Hopefully we can connect, in person when you're back in town. I know people fly you to dinners to Mexico, but maybe I can do something as well. When you're here,
I promise you the next time I'm in Frisco, it'd be entirely my pleasure and privilege to spend time with you and to pick up the thread where we leave this one off. Absolutely.
Perfect, perfect. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate your time, and looking forward again to connecting soon, and looking forward to seeing what Kidzania does for our community and for our children.
Perfect. Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Tomas Show. Please subscribe and share.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode with Dr. Gert Graus. It would truly mean the world to me if you went to the Apple Podcasts and left me a review, an honest review. It doesn't matter if it's a positive or negative, but I would love to hear your feedback. Again, Apple Podcasts, please, please, please go to your app and leave me a review and provide honest feedback about what you think about the podcast or this particular episode. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Cheers.